he says. It is the magic of manipulation, of speaking, of getting lesser creatures to bend to my will. It's why I was so good with my father's bees. But when I rely too much on it, it makes me into my worst self, a tyrant.
These creatures you can manipulate, I say. Do they include ghouls?
I'd not sully my mind by communicating with those little brutes.
A chitter comes from somewhere near Moose's feet, and I spot a flash of iridescence, like torchlight on water. It disappears, and Moose lifts his hands, which I could have sworn were empty a moment ago. Now he holds a scroll.
For you, he says.
I snatch the scroll from him, reading through it quickly before dropping my arm in disgust. This doesn't tell me anything.
It tells you that the blood shrike was injured.
He looks down at the parchment.
And that the paters have turned against her. Her survival is quite miraculous. Interesting. I wonder—
I don't care about the bleeding blood shrike or martial politics, I hiss. I need to know whom else the Nightbringer is spending his time with.
You sound like an ex-lover.
Moose lifts his eyebrows, and I realize he must know about me and Keenan, about what happened between us. Embarrassment floods me. I wish now that I hadn't opened up to him.
Ah, Laya Apan.
He uses the mariner honorific for little sister, and jostles me with an arm.
We've all made mistakes in love. Me most of all.
Love, I sigh. Love is joy coupled with misery, elation bound to despair. It is a fire that beckons me gently and then burns when I get too close. I hate love. I yearn for it, and it drives me mad. In any case, it is not something I want to discuss with anyone, least of all Moose. Among the paters, I say, is there anyone with whom the Nightbringer has spent more time? Another crooning chitter.
My friend here says he will find out.
I catch a glimpse of shimmering iridescent wings and shiver with sudden knowledge. Moose, I whisper, is that a bleeding white? Whites are fey, like wraiths, but smaller, swifter, and craftier. Stories say they are tricksters who enjoy luring humans to their deaths.
My little spies, swift as the wind, obsessed with candied almonds, which you might have noticed when you poked around my room.
He gives me an arch look, and I flush, embarrassed.
And they're actually very sweet creatures, once you get to know them.
Whites, I raise my eyebrows. A sweet?
I wouldn't cross one, no. But they're very loyal. More loyal than most humans, anyway.
And strangely, it is that comment, delivered almost defensively, that finally makes me less suspicious of Moose. I do not trust him, not yet. But I realize I like him. I did not know how much I missed having someone to talk to. With Darin, the simplest conversation sometimes feels like dancing on butterflies' wings. What of my end of the bargain? I ask. You're spreading my story and making me out to be some sort of hero.
Leader, actually.
I knew a deal with him wouldn't be as simple as recruiting resistance fighters. You want me to lead the resistance?
If I told you that in the prison cell, you'd have rejected my offer.
Because I have no wish to lead anyone. Look at what happened to my mother. To Mazen. Moose's calm only incenses me further. Why don't you do it yourself? Why me?
I'm a scholar of Adisa, Moose says. My family has lived here for more than 200 years. The refugees don't need me to speak for them. They need someone who understands their pain to plead their case before King Ermond.
I glance at him, alarmed. Is this what you meant when you said you wanted to work with the king? Have you forgotten that he wants to imprison Darin and me? And you?
That's Nicola's doing.
Moose shrugs off my protests.
I doubt she told her father she had you and Darin in her clutches. He's old, ailing. She's used his weakness to push the scholars out of Edessa and into the camps, to strip land and titles from Edessan scholars. But the princess doesn't rule yet. While the king lives, there's hope that he'll listen to reason, especially from the daughter of the lioness, who he considered a friend.
He catches sight of my face in the dark and chuckles.
Don't look so worried, he says. You won't go in unprepared. We'll have one chance to plead our case before the king. The future of our people depends on how successful we are. We need support from the refugees and Edessan scholars before then. It's why I've had you meet with so many of my friends. If we have enough scholars at our backs, King Ermond will have to listen to us.
But gathering so many will take time. Time I do not have. Guilt stabs through me. Musa has spent weeks building me up. But the moment I learn how to stop the Nightbringer, I'll have to depart Edessa. And where does that leave him? Alive. To fight, I tell myself firmly. Instead of dead in a gin-fueled apocalypse. Shortly after we reach the horses, a summer storm rolls in from the ocean, drenching us in minutes. Still wary, I insist that we ride through the night. Musa's whites report Tribe Salud's location, and we finally draw to a halt outside a coastal village, just as the fishing trawlers drift out to sea. The sodden fields around the village are thick with farmhands harvesting summer crops. Tribe Salud's wagons sit near the docks, a stone's throw from the village's only inn, where Musa takes rooms. I hope the Kahani know something about the Nightbringer. The approach of the grain moon, 7 weeks away, looms over me like an executioner's axe. Please. I cast my wish to the stars, hoping the universe is listening. Please let me learn something useful. Musa insists we clean up. She won't let us in her wagon if we smell of horse and sweat. By the time we emerge from the inn, a group of tribesmen awaits us. They greet Musa as an old friend, and me with a formal politeness. Without fanfare, we are led to the largest of the wagons, painted with purple fish and yellow flowers, white herons and crystalline rivers. Pendants of tarnished silver hang from the wagon's back, and when the door swings open, they jangle merrily. The Kehani wears a simple robe, instead of the finery of the other night, but her bearing is no less noble. The bracelets on her arms jingle, hiding the heavy, faded tattoos on her arms.
Musa of Edessa, she greets him. Still getting yourself into trouble you can't get out of. Always, Kehani. Ah, she watches him shrewdly. So you have finally seen her for what she is.
An old pain flashes in Musa's eyes, and I know that they are not speaking of me.
I have hope for her yet. Do not wait for her, child. Sometimes those we love are lost to us, as surely as if death himself had claimed them. All we can do is mourn the divergence of their path. If you try to walk it, you too will fall into darkness.
Musa opens his mouth as if to respond, but the Kehani turns to me.
You bring questions, liar of Sarah. Do you bring payment?
I have Sarek steel weapons, I say. 6 blades, freshly forged. The Kehani sniffs and summons one of her kinsmen. Musa catches my eye, and though he says nothing, I find myself fidgeting. I think of what Darin said.
You have your own strength. It doesn't have to be the same as the lioness's.
Wait. I place my hands on the weapons, just as the Kehani is handing them to the tribesmen. Please, I say, use them in defense. Use them to fight the soldiers. But not those who are innocent. Please. The tribesman looks at the Kehani questioningly. She murmurs something to him in Sadhis, and he steps out.
Liar of Sarah, you would tell a tribeswoman how to defend herself?
No, I twine my fingers together. I would ask that these blades, which are a gift, not be used to shed the blood of innocence.
Humph, the Kehani says. Then she leans over to the front of her wagon and offers me a small wooden bowl of salt. I breathe a sigh of relief and put a pinch on my tongue, the custom Afia taught me. We are under her tribe's protection now. None who belong to it may harm us.
Your gift is accepted, Lyre of Sarah. How may I aid you?
I heard you spinning the old tales in Edessa. Can you tell me of the djinn? Do they have any weaknesses? Is there a way to...
kill them, I nearly say. But the word is so cold.
Hurt them?
During the Fae Scholar War, your ancestors murdered the djinn with steel and salt and summer rain fresh from the heavens. But you ask the wrong question, Lyre of Sarah. I know of you. I know you do not seek to destroy the djinn. You seek to destroy the Nightbringer, and he is something else altogether.
Can it be done? Can he be killed?
The Kehani leans back in a pile of soft pillows and considers. The slide of her fingers against the wagon's lacquered wood sounds like sand hissing through an hourglass.
He is the first of his kind, she says. Rain will turn to steam on his skin, and steel to molten metal. As for salt, he will simply laugh to see it used against him, for he has inured himself to its effects. No, the Nightbringer cannot be killed. Not by a human, anyway. But he can be stopped.
How?
Rain thuds on the wooden roof of the wagon, and I'm reminded suddenly of the drums of the Empire, the way their tattoo echoed down into my bones, leaving me jittery.
Come back tonight, the Kehani says, when the moon is high, and I will tell you.
Musa sighs.
Kehani, with respect, tonight.
I shake my head.
But our stories are not bones left on the road for any hungry animal that happens along.
The Kehani's voice rises and I flinch back.
Our stories have purpose, souls. Our stories breathe, Lyre of Sarah. The stories we tell have power, of course, but the stories that go untold have just as much power, if not more. I will sing you such a story that was long untold. The story of a name and its meaning, of how that name matters more than any other single word in existence. But I must prepare myself, for such stories are dragons drawn from a deep well in a dark place. Does one summon a dragon? No. One may only invite it, and hope it emerges. So, tonight.
The Kehani refuses to say anything more, and soon Musa and I retreat to the inn, exhausted. He disappears into his room with a half-hearted wave. The tribeswoman said the Nightbringer can be stopped. Will she tell me how? I shiver in anticipation. What sort of story will she sing tonight?
A story that was long untold? The story of a name and its meaning?
I open the door to my room, still wondering. But at the threshold, I freeze. Because there is someone inside.
Chapter 24. Elias. Without the cottage to protect me, my mind is vulnerable to the djinn. But though I try to stay awake, I am, in the end, only human. Since becoming Soulcatcher, I have not dreamed. I only realize it now, when I open my eyes and find myself in a dark alley on an empty street. A flag flaps in the wind, black with crossed hammers. Marcus's sigil. I taste salt in the summer air, overlaid by something bitter. Blood, smoke, burnt stone. Whispers ride the air, and I recognize the sibilant tones of the djinn. Is this one of their illusions? Is it real? A whimper breaks the silence. A hooded figure slumps on the ground behind me. I watch for a moment before moving toward the figure. I'm wary as a pale hand emerges from a cloak, clenched tightly around a blade. But when I see the face beneath the hood, my caution disappears. It's the Bloodshrike. Blood blooms from her hunched body, staining the cobblestones around her, merciless and inexorable.
"I'm sorry,"
the Bloodshrike whispers when she sees me.
"For what I did to Mamie, the Empire..."
She coughs, and I crouch beside her, a hand on her back. She feels warm, alive.
"Who did this to you?"
Some part of me knows this is a dream, but that part fades and I'm simply in it, living it, as if it's real. The Shrike's face is drawn and white, her teeth chattering though the night is clear and warm. When I run my hands over her arms, trying to find her injury, she shudders, lifting back her cloak to show a wound in her belly. It looks bad. Very bad. "It's a dream. Just a dream." Still, fear stabs through me. I was angry at her when I last met her, but seeing her like this transfers my rage to whoever did this to her. Plans fall into place. Where is the nearest infirmary? Get her there. No, the barracks. Which barracks? But I can't do any of that. But this is a dream.
"Are you here to welcome me to... what did she call it? The waiting place?"
"You're not dead," I say. "And you're not going to die. Do you hear me?" A powerful memory hits me. The first trial. Marcus attacking her. The Shrike's too light body against mine as I carried her down the mountain. "You're going to live. You're going to find whoever did this to you. You're going to make them pay. Get up. Get to safety." Urgency grips me. I must say these words to her. I feel that knowledge in my bones. Her pupils dilate. Her body straightens.
"You are Bloodshrike of the Empire," I say. "And you are meant to survive. Get up!"
When she finds my eyes, her own are glassy. I catch my breath, for they are so real. The shape, the emotions, the color of them, like the violet heart of a quiet sea. The way her face changes beneath her mask, the stiffness of her jaw as she grits her teeth. But then she fades, as does the city. Silence descends. Darkness. When I open my eyes again, I expect to be back in the waiting place. But this time, I'm in a room I've never seen. The smooth wood floor is swept clean and strewn with mirrored cushions. There is a faint, familiar fragrance in the air, and my heart thuds faster, my body recognizing the scent before my mind does. The door opens and Lyra enters. Her dark hair has fallen loose from her braid, and she chews on her lip as she always does when she's deep in thought. The faint glow of a torch seeps in from the hallway behind her, lighting her face a soft gold brown. Purple half-moons shadow her eyes. The ocean thunders distantly, the creak of fishing boats a strange counter-melody to that roar. I step toward her, gripped by a soul-deep longing for her to be real. I want to hear her speak my name. I want to dip my hands into the cool shade of her hair, to take solace in her gaze. She freezes when she sees me, her mouth falling into an O.
You're here. How?
"It's a dream," I say. "I'm in the waiting place. I fell asleep."
"A dream?"
She shakes her head.
"No, Elias. You're real. I was just downstairs talking to Musa."
"Who the bleeding hells is Musa?"
"Jealous,"
she laughs, and immediately I want to hear her laugh again.
"Now I know this isn't a dream. Dream Elias would know that he never needs to be jealous."
"I'm not," I consider. "Never mind, I am jealous. Tell me he's old, at least, or grouchy, or maybe a bit stupid. He's young and handsome and smart. I snort. He's probably rubbishing, but... Lyra smacks me on the arm. Battle, I say quickly. I was going to say battle. He doesn't hold a candle to you. Lyra shakes her head. I must be more exhausted than I thought, but I could have sworn I was awake. I feel awake. Did you windwalk here? How could you if you were sleeping? I wish it weren't a dream, I say. I do, but it has to be. Otherwise I couldn't. I reach out my hand, and for a moment it hovers near hers. I take it, for once not dreading the interference of the ghosts, and she squeezes. Her palm fits perfectly against mine, and I lift her hand and brush my lips across her fingers. I couldn't do this, I speak softly. The ghosts, the waiting place, they wouldn't let me. Then tell me, dream Elias, she murmurs. What did you say to me? The night you left me in the tribal desert. The night you left me the note. What did you say? I said, I shake my head. Mamie Relay used to say that dreams are the bits of ourselves we can't face in the day, coming to visit at night. If I had never left Lyra that night, if Keenan had never gotten a chance to betray her, if I'd not been caught by the warden, if I'd never vowed to stay in the waiting place, then I wouldn't be stuck there for eternity. This dream version of Lyra questions me because I question myself. Part of me knows I should pay attention to those questions, that they are a weakness I should crush. But most of me just wants to revel in the fact that I am seeing Lyra, and I wasn't sure I ever would again. I miss you. She pushes back a curl, and I can't take my eyes off the skin of her wrist, disappearing into a bell-shaped sleeve, or the hollow in her neck, or the shape of her legs, long and perfectly curved in riding breeches. It's a dream, Elias, I remind myself sternly, trying to ignore how badly I want to feel those legs wrapped around me. Of course her legs look incredible and perfect, and I wish we could. When she puts her hand to my face, I savor the whirls in her fingertips, the gentle scrape of her nails. I look down into her eyes, golden and endless and full of all the desire I feel. I don't want this to disappear. I don't want to wake up to ghosts howling and djinn plotting. I unravel her braid. She takes my other hand and puts it on her hip, and I trace the curve with a light touch that makes her close her eyes. Why is it like this? She asks. Why must we be apart? I miss what we should have been, Elias. Is that possible? Her hand drops to my chest, to the shredded remains of my shirt, torn in the battle with the ghosts. What the skies happened to you? She looks me over with a healer's concern. And why do you smell like smoke? Self-examination again. Her questions are my own subconscious, holding me accountable for my mistakes. If Fritz burned down Shavers, my house, part of a djinn trick to torment me. No, she pales. Why? The Nightbringer. Perhaps. He must have sent the Ifrits, and the djinn in the grove told them when it was safe to enter the forest. I shake my head. I'm nothing like Shaver, Lyra. I'm not getting the ghosts through fast enough. Three of them escaped and did terrible things. I can't control the djinn, and I can't stop the ghosts suffering. It is my fault, Lyra slumps. If I hadn't trusted him, given him the armlet, he wouldn't have gone after her. Shaver should never have died. It's such a Lyra thing to say that I stare at her, perplexed. This is a dream, is it not? And the Bloodshrike, I hope that was a dream. I expect Lyra to say something, I would think. Instead, she continues to berate herself. I ask myself every day why I did not see him for what he was. No. I brush away the tears from her black eyelashes. Don't blame yourself. My voice is low, scratchy. Why have I forgotten how to talk? Please, it's not. She lifts her face, and my desire for her pools low and sudden. I can't stop myself from pulling her body to mine. She gasps softly and rises. Her lips against mine are urgent. She doesn't know when she'll kiss me again. The same frantic need courses through me. My mind shouts at me that this is too real. But no ghosts trouble us. I want her. She wants me. And we have wanted each other for so long. She pulls away from the kiss, and I'm certain I will wake up, that this sky's given time with her, devoid of ghosts railing at us, or Martha pulling at me, is about to end. But she only shoves away the remnants of my shirt, before running her nails gently across my skin, sighing with pleasure, or want, or both. I can't bear her lips away from mine, so I dip down again, but on my way I'm distracted by her shoulder. I find myself kissing it, then nipping at her neck, a primal part of me deeply satisfied by the moan I elicit from her, by the way her body relaxes into mine. As her breath heaves, more ragged with every kiss on her throat, I feel her twine her leg around mine. Yes, and I drop my hands to lift her up. The bed is too far, but there's a wall, and when I pin her against it, she rakes her hand across my back, murmuring, Yes, Elias, yes, until I am shaking with need. The things, I whisper in her ear, that I want to do to you. Tell me. Her tongue flicks across my ear, and I forget to breathe. Show me. When she wraps her legs around my waist, when I feel the heat of her against me, it undoes me, and I flip her onto her back on the bed and drop down over her. She draws circles on my chest, and then moves her hand lower, lower. I curse in Sariz and capture her wrist. Me first, I say, tracing the indent of her stomach and, spurred on by her size, dropping my hand further. Moving in time with her body until she arches her back, her arms trembling against my neck. As we both start to rid ourselves of clothes, our eyes meet. She smiles at me, a sweet smile, unsure and hopeful and bemused. I know that smile. I think about it all the time. But it is not a smile a dream could ever recreate. And this feeling within me, my desire, hers, they are also not emotions a dream could ever simulate. Could this be real? Could I have windwalked here somehow? Who bleeding cares? You're here now. But I hear something. Whispers. The same whispers I heard when I was with the Bloodshrike. The djinn. A warning flares down my spine. This isn't a dream. Lyra is here, in this inn. I am here. And if I'm here, then it's the djinn who have done it. How the bleeding hells did they move me? How did they know where Lyra was? And why have they brought me here? I pull my hands away to sit up, and she growls in disappointment. You're right, I say. I am here. This is real. But it shouldn't be.
Elias, she laughs again. It has to be a dream, or we couldn't do this. But it is the best dream.
She reaches for me again, pulling me down.
You're exactly like you. Now, where were...
She pauses, and it's as if the world has frozen. Nothing moves, not even the shadows. A moment later, the world unfreezes, and Lyra shudders, as if a chill has entered her very blood. Or her mind. But when she looks at me, She is no longer Lyre. Her eyes are pure white, and I jump away from her as she shoves me, her strength unnatural. A ghost? My mind screams. Skies, is she possessed?
Go back!
Her voice has completely changed, and I recognize it as the voice that spoke out of Shava when I took my vow to become Soulcatcher. The voice that spoke to me in that strange in-between place when Shava stole me away from the raid. Ma'atha's voice. Lyra's whole body shifts, changing into shadow. Her features faded, her body unfamiliar.
Where is she? I demand. What did you do with her? Go back. The djinn deceive you. They use your weakness against you. Go back.
Ma'atha, in Lyra's shadow form, swings at me, as if trying to beat me toward the waiting place. I'm thrown backward by the blow.
Stop this!
I lift my hands. Who brought me here? Was it you? Was it the djinn?
The djinn, you fool,
says Ma'atha, for I won't allow myself to think of him as Lyre, no matter what form he takes.
They siphon the power that you do not use. They strengthen themselves. They distract you with the laws of the human world. The more you feel, the more you fail. The more you fail, the stronger they become.
How are you talking to me? I say. Are you possessing her? Are you hurting her?
Her fate is not your concern.
Ma'atha shoves me, but I plant my feet.
Her life is not your concern.
If you've hurt her...
She will not remember this, any of this,
Ma'atha says.
Go back, surrender to me. Forget your past, forget your humanity. You must. Do you see? Do you understand?
I cannot, I say. It's part of me, but I need the magic.
The magic will allow you to pass the ghosts through with nary a thought. It will allow you to quell the djinn. But you must leave your old self behind. You are Elias Veturius no more. You are the soul catcher. You are mine. I know what your heart desires. It can never be.
I tried desperately to push those wishes away. So stupid, so small. A house and a bed and a garden and laughter and a future.
Forget your dreams.
Ma'atha's anger mounts.
Forget your heart. There is only your vow to serve me. Love cannot live here. Seek out the djinn. Find their secrets. Then you will understand.
I'll never understand, I say. I'll never let go of what I fought so hard to keep.
You must, Elias. Otherwise, all is lost.
Ma'atha spins out of Lyre, a teeming cyclone of cindered shadows, and she collapses in a heap. I take one step toward her before Ma'atha yanks me into darkness. Seconds or minutes or hours later, I slam into the singed earth outside Shaver's cabin. Warm summer rain falls in sheets, drenching me within seconds. Bleeding, burning hells, it was real. I was with Lyre in Marin, and she won't even remember it. I was with the Bloodshrike in Navium. Did she survive her wound? I should have helped her, gotten her to the barracks. Just thinking of them ignites Ma'atha's wrath. I double over, hissing at the fire that tears through me.
Seek out the djinn. Find their secrets.
Martha's order rings through my head. But I sought the djinn's help once before. They used it to bedevil me so the spirits could escape. The commandant's words float through my mind. There is success, and there is failure. The land in between is for those too weak to live. I need to get to the magic. And to do that, Ma'atha, at least, thinks I need the djinn. But this time, I won't go to those creatures as Elias Veturius. I won't even go to them as the Soulcatcher. I'll go to them as Mask Veturius, Dread Marshal, Soldier of the Empire. I'll go to them as the estranged, murderous son of the Bitch of Blackcliff, as the monster who killed his friends and assassinated the Empire's enemies as a child, and who watched stonily as yearlings were whipped to death before his eyes. This time, I will not ask the djinn for help. I will take it.
Chapter 25. The Bloodshrike. You are Bloodshrike of the Empire, and you are meant to survive. Who spoke the words? I tried to grasp at the memory. Someone was here, on this dark street with me. A friend. But when I open my eyes and pull myself to my knees, I am alone, left with nothing but the echo of those words. My knees shake as I try to pull myself to my feet, but no matter how deeply I breathe, I can't get any bleeding air. Because you're losing all your blood, Shrike. I rip off my cloak and tie it around my stomach, groaning at the pain of it. Now is when I need a damned patrol to pass, but of course the commandant, who no doubt planned this, would make sure there was none. But there might be more assassins. I have to get up, get to the Blackguard barracks. Why? A voice whispers. The darkness waits with open arms. Your family waits. Mother. Father. I need to remember something about them. I fist my hands and feel something cold, round. I look down. A ring. A bird in flight. You are all that holds back the darkness. Someone said those words to me. But no, those words do not matter. Not against the pain that slams through me. Waves and waves of it. You are all that holds back the darkness. The memory burns in my mind. I put a hand to my eyes, and my mask ripples. The cool metal lends me strength as nothing else can, snapping me out of my torpor. My father spoke those words to me. Livia, the baby, the regency. My family lives, the Empire lives, and I must protect both. I crawl forward, teeth gritted, enraged at the tears streaming unchecked down my face, at the astounding pain of my wound. Break it down. How many steps to the barracks? It's a quarter mile from here at least. 500 strides at most. 500 strides is nothing. What about when you get there? What if someone sees you? Will you let your men see you weak? What if someone spots you on the way? The assassin can't possibly be alone. Then I will fight his accomplices too, and I will live, because if I do not, all is lost. I look down at my father's ring and force myself forward, taking strength from it. I am a mask. I am an Aquila. I am the Bloodshrike. Pain is nothing. I reach the wall of a nearby house and drag myself to my feet. The houses are darkened at this time of night, and though I might find aid at one of them, I might also find enemies. The commandant is nothing if not thorough. If she sent an assassin, then she'd pay off the street where he was meant to kill me, to make sure no one helped. Move, Shrike. I make it down the street before my legs begin feeling strange. Cold. I slow down, hoping to catch my breath. And then suddenly, I'm not moving anymore. I'm on my knees. Bleeding hells. I know this feeling. Weakness. Uselessness. helplessness. I felt it before, after Marcus stabbed me during the first trial. Elias saved me then, because he was, is my friend. How could I ever see him as anything else after what we have been through? If I am sorry for anything now, before the end, it is that I hunted him, that I hurt his family, that I hurt him. Will I see him now, in the waiting place? Will he welcome me? What folly that he is chained to that place. What folly when this world needs his light. You deserved better, I whisper. Shrike! The scrape of boots has me baring my teeth and brandishing my dagger. But I recognize the black hair and gold skin, and though I'm confused, I'm not really surprised, because he is my best friend after all, and he'd never let me just die. You came. Shrike, listen to me. Stay awake. Stay with me. But no, it's not Elias. The voice doesn't offer the slow, deep warmth of summer. It's cool and harsh, all wrong. It's winter, like me. Then there's another voice, also familiar, Dex. There's a physician in the Aquila house. Get him, the cool voice says. Help me with her armor first. She'll be easier to carry. Careful with her stomach. I know the first voice now. Avitas Harper. Strange, quiet Harper. Thoughtful and watching and filled with an emptiness that calls to me. He works quickly to unbuckle my armor, and I stifle a moan when it comes off. Dex's handsome, dark face, strained in the half-light, clarifies. A good soldier. A true friend. But he's always in pain. Always alone. Hiding. It's not fair, I whisper to him. You should love whom you wish. How the Empire would treat you if they knew. It's not... Dex's face pales, and he glances quickly at Avitas. Save your strength, Shrike, he says. Then he's gone, and a muscled arm comes around my waist. Harper pulls my hand across his shoulders, and we take a step, another, but I'm staggering. I've lost too much blood. Pick me up, you idiot, I gasp. A moment later I am weightless, and I sigh. You're going to be fine, Hell, Shrike, a crack in Harper's voice. Emotion? Fear? Don't let anyone see me, I whisper. This is undignified. A bark of laughter. Only you would think that while your guts are leaking out onto the damned pavement. Hold on, Bloodshrike. The barracks aren't far. He makes for the front entrance, and I shake my head emphatically. Take me through the back. The plebeians we're sheltering can't see me like this. We don't have a choice. The fastest way to the infirmary is through the front door. No! I thrash and shove Harper's chest. He doesn't so much as twitch. They cannot see me like this. You know what she'll do. She'll use it against me. The paters already think I'm weak. Captain Avitas Harper. Harper freezes at the voice, deep and ancient and brooking no argument. Bring her this way. You get the bleeding hells away from us. Harper backs away two steps, but the Nightbringer holds out his hands. I could kill you both with a thought, child, he says softly. If you wish for her to live, bring her. Harper hesitates for a moment, and then follows. I want to protest, but my mouth is unable to form words. His body is taut as a wire pulled tight, heart thudding swift like a river current. But his masked face is serene. Some part of me relaxes. My sight darkens. Ah, sleep. Stay with me, Shrike. Harper speaks sharply, and I groan in protest. Keep your eyes open. You don't have to speak. All you have to do is stay awake. I force myself to focus on the swirling robes of the Nightbringer. He whispers, but I cannot make out the words. A brick wall that rose before us disappears. Magic. Moments later, the barracks come into view. The guards stationed outside look up, hands on their sims. But the Nightbringer speaks again, and they turn away as if they haven't seen us.
Set her down, Captain.
We enter my quarters, and the Nightbringer gestures to my bed.
And then, leave.
Harper settles me onto the bed slowly. Still I grimace, another wave of pain washing over me at the strain on my wound. When he backs away, I feel cold.
I will not leave her.
He straightens and looks the Nightbringer in the face without flinching. The Nightbringer considers.
Very well. Get out of the way.
The djinn sits beside me on the bed. He throws back my shirt and I catch a glimpse of his hand beneath the sleeve of his robe. It is shadowy and twisted, with an eerie glow beneath the darkness that makes me think of banked embers. I think of a day long ago in Sarah, the first time I met him. I remember how he sang, just one note, and the bruises on my face healed. Why are you helping me?
I cannot help you, the Nightbringer says. You can, however, help yourself.
Can't heal myself.
Your healing power allows you to recover more quickly than a normal human,
he says. Distantly I realize that Arvatas is hearing all of this, that maybe I should have had him leave the room. But I am too weak to care.
How else could you still live, child, after losing so much blood? Consider the wound, and then find your song. Do it. Now.
The words are not a request, but an order. I hum tunelessly, fighting the pain, searching for my song. I close my eyes and I am a girl again, comforting Hannah when she came into my bed at night, terrified of monsters. Mother would find us huddling together and sing us to sleep. Sometimes in the deep night at Blackcliff, thinking of her song brought me peace. But when I sing now, nothing happens. Why would it? My song is not one of peace. It is one of failure and pain. My song is one of battle and blood, death and power. It is not the song of Helene Aquila. It is the song of the Bloodshrike. And I cannot find it. I cannot wrap my mind around it. This is it, then. Cut down on the street like a drunk civvy who couldn't tell a blade from a bottle. The Nightbringer sings two notes. Rage, I think. Love. A raw, cold world lives in that short song. My world. Me. I sing the two notes back to him. Two notes become four. Four become 14. Rage for my enemies, I think. Love for my people. This is my song. But it hurts. Bleeding hells, it hurts. The Nightbringer takes my hand.
Pour the pain into me, child, he says. Turn it away from yourself.
His words unleash a flood. Even as the burden of my wound transfers to him, he does not flinch. He does not move at all, his cloaked form a statue as he accepts it. My skin stitches itself back together, burning with an ache that makes me cry out. A blade hisses as it leaves its sheath.
What the bleeding hells did you do to her?
The Nightbringer turns to Arvatas and gestures. Immediately, Harper drops the sim as if burned.
Look.
The djinn moves, nodding down to my wound, which is now nothing but a star-shaped scar. It weeps blood, but it will not kill me. Harper's low oath tells me that I will soon have a great deal of explaining to do, but I can worry about that later. My body is exhausted, but when the Nightbringer releases me, I make myself sit up. "Wait," I whisper. "Will you tell her of this?" He knows of whom I speak.
"Why would I tell her? So that she can attempt to kill you again? I am not her servant, Bloodshrike. She is mine. She attacked you against my orders. I have no patience for defiance. Thus, I have thwarted her."
"I don't understand. Why would you help me? What do you want from me?"
"I am not helping you, Bloodshrike." He stands and gathers his robes. "I am helping myself."
When I wake, night has fallen, and the rafters shudder with reverberations of catapult projectiles. The barbarians must have recommenced their bombardment of Navium. I am alone in my room, but my armor is hung neatly from the wall. A curse slips through my lips as I rise. My wound has gone from deadly to irritatingly painful. "Stop whinging. Get your armor on." I limp to the wall, every joint as stiff as an old woman's in deep winter. I hope a few minutes on my feet will warm up my body enough that I can at least ride.
"Off to get yourself killed again so soon?"
The familiar rasp is so unexpected that I don't believe I'm hearing it at first.
"Your mother would be appalled."
Cook perches in the window as usual, and even with the hood, even though I've seen her scars before, the violence of her mangled face is jarring enough that I look away. Her cloak is ripped, her shock of white hair a bird's nest. The yellow stains on her fingers tell me immediately who has been leaving clay statues in the commandant's quarters.
"I heard you got stabbed."
The cook drops into the room.
"Thought I'd come yell at you for allowing it to happen."
She shakes her head.
"You're a fool. You should know better than to walk alone at night within 100 miles of the bitch of Blackcliff."
"And leave you to kill her," I snort. "Hasn't worked out well for you, has it? All you've done is left a few disturbing statues in her quarters." Cook grins, an eerie thing.
"I'm not trying to kill her."
She does not elaborate. Her gaze drops to my stomach.
"You haven't thanked me for murdering the other assassins who were coming for you. All for telling Harper to stop squinting at reports so we could drag your carcass to safety."
"Thank you," I say.
"I trust you know that sun-eyed bastard wants something from you."
I don't waste time asking how she knows the Nightbringer healed me. "I don't trust him," I tell her. "I'm not a fool."
"Then why did you let him help you? He's planning a war, did you know? And he's likely got a part in it for you. You just don't know what it is yet."
"A war?" I sit up. "The war with the Karkans?" Cook hisses, snatches a candle off a table near the door, and throws it at my head.
"Not that war, stupid. The war. The one that's been brewing since the day my idiot people decided it would be wise to attack and destroy the djinn. That's what this is all about, girl. That's what the Commandant is up to. It's not just the Karkans she wants to defeat."
"Explain yourself," I say. "What are you—"
"Get out of here,"
she says.
"Get far away from the Commandant. She's set on taking you down, and she'll have her way. Go to your sister. Keep her safe. Keep that Emperor of yours in check. And when the war does come, be ready for it.
I must take down the Commandant first, I say. This war you speak of. A step sounds in the hallway beyond the door. Cook leaps into the window, one hand coiled around the frame. I notice something strange about that hand. The skin is smooth, not young like mine, but not the skin of a white-haired granny either. Those dark blue eyes pin me.
You want to take down the bitch of Blackcliff? You want to destroy her? You have to become her first. And you don't have it in you, girl.
Chapter 26. Liar.
I am fuzzy-headed and confused when I pull on my boots. I've slept all day. Such strange dreams I had. Wonderful, and yet...
Liar! Moose's voice is a low hiss at the door. Bleeding hells, are you all right? Liar!
The door bursts open before I can get a word out, and Moose takes two steps in and grabs my shoulders as if to make sure I am real.
Get your things.
He scans the windows and beneath the bed.
We need to get the hells out of here.
What's happened? I say. My thoughts immediately go to the Nightbringer, to his minions. Is he...
Wraiths.
Moose's face is pale to the color of an unpolished sim.
They attacked Tribe Salud, and they might be coming for us.
Oh, no. No. The Kehani!
I don't know if she's alive, he says, and we can't risk finding out. Come on.
We race down the back stairs of the inn and out to the stables as silently as possible. It is late enough that most of the village is in bed, and waking anyone would only bring about questions, and a delay.
The Wraiths killed everyone silently, Moose says. I wouldn't have known anything was wrong if the Whites hadn't woken me up.
I pause as I throw a saddle onto my horse. We should make sure there are no survivors, Moose swings up onto his mount.
If we go into that camp, skies know what we'll find.
I faced a wraith before, I finish with my horse. There were nearly 50 tribespeople in that camp, Moose. If even one of them is alive, Moose shakes his head.
Most of them left early. Only a few wagons stayed with the Kehani to keep watch over her until she was ready to leave. And she stayed because...
Because of us, I say. Which is why we owe it to her to make sure neither she nor any of her kinsmen needs help. He groans in protest, but follows me as I leave the stables and head for the camp. I expect it to be silent, but the steady drizzle of rain pings off the wagon roofs, making it difficult for us to hear our own footsteps. The first body is sprawled at the entrance to the encampment. It is wrong. Broken in a dozen different ways. A lump rises in my throat. I recognize the man, one of the tribesmen who welcomed us. Three more of his family members lie a few yards from him. I know instantly that they too are dead. But we do not see the Kehani. A quiet chitter near Moose's ear tells me that the Whites have noticed her absence too. Moose nods to the Kehani's wagon. When I make for it, Moose puts an arm in front of me.
Open.
The strain on his face matches the foreboding in my heart.
Maybe I should go first.
In case... I saw the inside of Koff Prison, Moose. I slip past him.
It can't be any worse.
The back door opens silently, and I find the Kehani, crumpled against the far wall. She looks so much smaller than she did just hours ago. An old woman, whose last story was stolen from her. The wraiths did not cut her. In fact, I do not see a single open wound. But the odd angles of her limbs tell me exactly how she died. I clap my hand against my mouth to hold back my sick. Skies, she must have been in so much pain. A moan comes from her, and both Moose and I jump. Oh, bleeding hells! I am by her side in two steps. Moose, go to the horses. Look in the right saddlebag. No. The Kehani's sunken eyes gleam with faint, failing light. Listen. Moose and I both fall silent. We can barely hear her over the rain. Seek out the Augur's words, she whispers. Prophecy. The great Library. Augurs? I don't understand. What do the augurs have to do with the Nightbringer?